thank you everyone for coming. You can sign the phone, we're going to begin now. As a way of introduction, tonight's panel is Halacha and Common Law, the topic is necessity. The two guests standing on the panel for us tonight is Rabbi Moshe Aziz. He's our very own rabbi of Oris there. He has authored several books to date in Halacha, including Shnot Chaim, Laws and Customs of Jewish Mourning, Tarat Chaim, Laws of Family Purity, Onot Chaim, Laws of Marital Relations, and Tzedakah L'Chaim, Laws of Tzedakah Maaser. Gideon Shirazi is recognized as a leading trial appellate, lawyer and commercial construction, IT, telecom, shipping, and commodities, disputes in chambers and partners, Legal 500, Legal 500 Asia, Pacific, and Legal 500 Middle East, and by global data review is one of the top 40 lawyers under 40 globally for data law. The way the panel is going to work is they're going to discuss different cases from both the halakha view as well as the common law view. So, if you're, without further ado, I guess, come.
So, can a man steal a loaf of bread to feed his starving family? So a man walks into a store, he grabs a loaf of bread, he walks out without paying. He's starving. Doesn't have a choice. Does he commit a crime? Is he guilty of theft? Is he guilty of larceny? What about from a compensation perspective? Can the shopkeeper sue him and say, you've got to pay me for this? You've got to give me damage, you've got to give me compensation. Two different questions, but really dealing with the same issue. What happens when you don't have a choice? Not when someone's holding a gun to your head and says, do this or I'll kill you, or puts you under some other kind of duress. Not a scenario where you try and do something and everything fundamentally changes. You're standing on ground and it opens up and swallows you whole. Frustration, force majeure. Lots and lots of other types of doctrines. But a situation where, because of the circumstances you find yourself in, through no fault of your own, you have no choice. You could either do one thing, which in any other circumstance would be a wrong, or you can do nothing and something catastrophic will happen. That's what we're talking about. That when that scenario takes place, in law, that's called necessity. And the question is, when does necessity exempt you from a crime or from liability? I'm going to talk about this from the common law perspective. Common law is really the law that applies in America. But it's more than the law that applies in America. It's the law that applies across about a third of the world. About a third of the world, people follow common law. Common law essentially comes from the English system, adopted over the last 1,000 years in England, and spread across the British Empire. So places like 49 out of the 50 states of the United States were the US territories, other than Puerto Rico, all of the Canadian provinces and territories, other than Quebec, Australia, New Zealand, India, Singapore, Hong Kong, Pakistan, you name it, these countries are applying the common law when looking at lots of legal questions. And so the common law is a way to work through traditions for a hell of a lot of secular people and religious people across the world. In terms of the way that it works, common law really is judge-made law. So cases come to court, judges decide those cases based on the facts that are in front of them and applying the principles of law that have been identified in other cases and in other situations, specific concrete situations, not abstract theoretical ones, but specific concrete ones. And then they apply those previous rulings. The rulings, once they're made, become legally binding precedents. And a later judge that can't reach a different ruling just because they disagree with it normally. Sometimes they can. But generally, once there's a law, once there's a case that sets down a rule, that's it. That's followed by later judges. I told you that about a third of the world has the common law. Obviously, it's diverged in some different places. So the way in which a particular question might be answered under New York law, for example, might be different to the way in which it's decided under Californian law, Texas law, the law in Singapore. And generally speaking, the earlier a place in the world got independence from the British Empire, the less similar the common law is between the two places. So if you're asking a question and you want to know how it applies under Hong Kong law and English law is more likely to be similar than California and New York law. And that's the basic way that it works. And so to decide something under a common law perspective, you go back to previous cases and you analyze the principles that apply.
Well, first of all, thank you, Giron. Thank you, Melody, for bringing Giron to our community. it's really been such an honor and pleasure to get to know Giron in these past couple of years. I also just have to acknowledge my father and my mother who are here today. Thank you for being here with the session. And also my father-in-law and my mother-in-law who are also here. Thank you for coming. Halacha. So how does Jewish law work? How does halacha work? Most rabbis, as part of rabbinical training and as part of being rabbis, you have to learn a little bit how to be a jurist. You have to be an expert in some form in law. And you have to study law and know law very, very well and how Jewish law works. And how does Jewish law work in a broad sense, in a general sense? So we believe the Torah was given to us at Har Sinai. We have a Torah. The Torah is the book. The Jewish people are the people of the book. Right? This is the book where everything stems from. It is holy. It's Kadosh, of course. Our Torah is holy. It was given to us by Hashem. Right? There, unlike the Constitution, there's no amendments to the Torah. There's no changes to the Torah. Once it was given by Hashem, and it was perfect. As part of giving us the Torah, Hashem, also, it says in the Torah, there is a legal system. There is a system for how do you clarify any new cases that come up after the Torah. The Torah might give an injunction and might say very clearly, Lo tirzach, it's prohibited to kill. But then you can have all kinds of questions that are not addressed directly in those two words. Is it only people that you're allowed to kill? Are you allowed to kill animals? Is that under Lo tirzach or is it not? Are you allowed to kill a tree? Is that considered killing or is it not? Are you allowed to do abortion? Is that considered killing or is it not? All kinds of questions that are gray areas that are not directly addressed by the Torah. Who has the authority to interpret? Can any person just say, I can interpret what the Torah means and what the law is going to be? So the Torah gives power to a court system, and the head of that court system is a Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin, the Beit Din HaGadol, the Supreme Court, if you will, who has the ultimate authority to interpret the Torah. To some degree, their authority is limited. They can't change anything that's actually written in the Torah. You can't add or delete any words of the Torah or change anything that it actually says. But something that's gray or not clear in the Torah, the Sanhedrin has the authority to interpret what does the Torah mean whenever a new case comes before you. The Torah has to cover everything. It has to cover ritual laws, which probably most of the rabbis nowadays deal with ritual law, but the Torah also has criminal law, civil law, family law, all different types of areas of law are addressed by the Torah and in Jewish law. Over the course of history, most of those interpretations were kept orally. We had oral law, some of it that was really transmitted directly from Moshe Rabbeinu, some of it that might have come throughout history at different times, but we had an oral law. It was preserved orally. It wasn't published. It was only first published, the oral law and all of the traditions of interpretations, first in the times of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasir, Rabbi Judah the Prince. And that first work, which was printed and published, was called the Mishnah. Now, without getting too much into detail, the Mishnah and Rabbi Yura Hanasi, they were the last Sanhedrin that we know, the last Bedina Gadol that had the authority to interpret the Torah, and whose law and whose word became binding on all of Israel, and is considered binding law for halakha for all of us. After that, there was a time period for about 200 years where there were discussions around the Mishnah. There were conventions where all of the great rabbis representing all of the great communities and their students would get together and have conventions discussing Jewish law. And eventually, about 200 years later, around 400 CE, the Babylonian Talmud was published, Talmud Bavli, also known as the Gemara. And the Gemara is the final, it's the last book that we have. It was published in 400 CE, and it has many, many volumes, 36 volumes, which are interpreting at least 60 volumes of the Mishnah. And that's the last work that we have, which is nationally binding. That across all of Israel, there was acceptance that this is our book of law, and that was the Talmud. After the Talmud, I'm trying to keep this very short because we got to get into these very fascinating cases that we're going to talk about, both from the perspective of common law and halakha. But after the Talmud, after 400 CE, what happened was the Jewish communities branched out across the world and were never able to get one body together, one unified body that represents all of Israel. So Jews spread out to Europe, to North Africa, to all different areas of the world. And you had rabbis and who had batei din, who had courts, that may have had binding authority over their local communities. We had local batei din, but no rabbis who represented all of Israel. You could say that his word represents all of Israel. Any rabbi who wants to say something or wants to issue an opinion on something from 400 CE until now, whether it be about electricity or whatever it is, they have to in some kind of way compare it to something that's in the Talmud. It has to be something that's in the Gemara and use that as a paradigm and as a model, together with interpretations and the well-known interpretations of the Talmud, which developed over the years. The very famous ones of Rashi, of Tosfot, very famous jurists like the Rambam, who codified all of the conclusions of the Talmud. That was Maimonides. Another very famous code that almost all of us follow is the Shulchan Aruch, written by Rav Yosef Karo. So many, many over the course of history, but essentially any rabbi nowadays, or since that time, who issues an opinion, they have to write it. It's the equivalent of a law professor, Lehavdil ben Kodesh Lechol, because we believe that great rabbis they have the spirit of Hashem divinely inspiring them in their writing, but they have to write a legal opinion, the equivalent of, so to speak, a law professor issuing an opinion on a certain case. It's not binding on all of Israel, it's an opinion. And if that opinion becomes accepted by a community, or that opinion becomes accepted across multiple communities, let's say the Sephardic communities accept that more than the Ashkenazi opinions, it becomes binding because it's accepted by the Sephardic opinions, or it's accepted within the community. Or sometimes the rabbis of a certain community will make a certain enactment for that community, similar to our Takana and our Meshari Takana, which was adopted by our community. And that's binding on our community. That becomes binding, but it's not binding on all of Israel. It's not binding for the rest of the Jewish people. All of this will be until one day, hopefully, and we hope that we're in that direction, but maybe in the times of Mashiach, and thankfully we have Israel, and we're one step closer, but we still don't have it, but maybe we're going to have a Sanhedrin again. Maybe we're going to have a body that is representative of all the Jewish people, Sfaradim, Ashkenazim, Hasidim, all of the Jews from all across the world will have a representative on the Sanhedrin, and they're going to decide law for everybody, and we're going to have one law, hopefully one day we'll get back to that. But that's the general sense of how halakha works and how law works. If anybody wants to interrupt with questions, feel free for either of us, but we'll hopefully leave a few minutes at the end if anybody wants to ask.
So, Barrister, it's very interesting that French Revolution actually started with somebody stealing a loaf of bread, as you gave an example. But the rabbi, his specific point was, what does halakha talk about a necessity?
So we're going to see now. So we have about
necessity. Well, stole a loaf of bread.
Well, we'll see.
So we have a few cases to present that we're going to talk about, both from the perspective of common law and halakha, and what halakha has to say about those cases.
So the way that common law works, the way it explains, is you look back and you say, what are the previous cases that have decided these kind of questions? One of those cases was one from the 1880s, and this caused a stir across the English-speaking world. Everyone was obsessed with this. So a very wealthy American lawyer finds out that there's a pleasure yacht that's available for sale in Australia. He says, I'd like to buy this. It takes him a while to find a crew who's prepared to sail it across to America, but he does. It's a crew of four people, captained by a man called Mr. Dudley. Captain, first mate, chief engineer, and cabin boy. What happens is, they're going along from Australia, they go round to the bottom of the coast of Africa, the Cape of Good Hope. I can see some nods that makes me think some people know the case I'm talking about. And what happens is, just off the Cape of Good Hope, disaster. The ships lose control of the vessel. It cracks, it starts falling apart. They quickly scramble, get onto a lifeboat. It's not a very good lifeboat, it's a bit rickety and broken. All they manage to grab is two cans of carrots. That's it. They don't have any fresh water, they don't have anything. Four men on this lifeboat. Within 5 minutes, the yacht has sunk. They're too far from the shore to get back. After 2 weeks of sitting there starving, no fresh water, no anything else, some of them are falling ill. And they join together and they say, we should draw lots and kill one of us, eat them, and then the rest of us will survive. Kill one, save three. They're not really sure what to do about this. A couple of days later, the cabin boy is looking very, very sickly. The captain takes his knife, says a quick prayer, they're very religious Christians, stabs him in the neck. For the next 3 days, they feast on his blood and flesh. They said that it was the best meal they'd ever had. And then a few days after that, they sight sails. They get collected by actually the German Navy, who bring them eventually to England, where they get put on trial for murder. Among other things, they say, we had no choice. We had to kill this cabin boy, otherwise we would all have died. Are they guilty of murder? Let's make this fun. Let's take a quick vote. Who thinks, by a show of hands, who thinks they are guilty of murder? And who thinks that because they had no choice, necessity meant that they had to kill the guy, and that's a defense. They didn't have a choice. This isn't a normal situation.
The jury has spoken.
a slightly smaller number.
This is a true story. Look at it.
Why the cabin boy? The reason they went for the cabin boy is there are three reasons actually. The first is that when they did the straws, he ended up pulling the short straw, but then they sort of left it for 2 days. Everyone decided that was a bad thing. Secondly, he was sick. And thirdly, he didn't have a family. Whereas the first mate and the captain, the chief engineer, did. And they said, better that he died than us. maybe he was fat.
I guess the crux that he was the cabin boy, he was was not of any level of the society or of the future, so they can kill
him. Well, the judge, that certainly played part of the thinking. So that it goes on trial. It's a particular special type of trial that takes place, that where the jury finds the facts. The judge says, this is what the law is, the way you just find the facts and we'll reach a conclusion. And then it goes to a panel of all the judges to decide what's the law here. And what they do is they look back in the law books. There's no law. They can't find any precedent for this situation. They do find lots of commentary about this, going back all the way to the times of the Roman Empire and Roman law and international codes and things like that. But ultimately, they say, so far as English law is concerned, and it's the same in America, it's the same across the common law world, you can't kill someone to save yourself. That's not a defense to murder. Would it have been different if it was property? Maybe not. Would it have been different if it was not an active act of murder? Don't know.
Does law apply to where the crime occurred or the origin of the country?
Really great question. There was a big argument about why England had the ability to try these guys. They were British citizens, and they were under a British flagged ship. So English law applied to the vessel because it was a British flagged vessel. But there was an argument about whether or not they were entitled to be tried. There's also a question about whether that would be that could be tried anywhere. Halakha.
So halakha. So what does the halakha say in this case? You have a life and death situation. Is someone allowed to murder somebody and eat them in order to save their own life? Okay. So in the Talmud, in the Gemara, there are several pages in Masechet Sanhedrin which discuss which commandments and which mitzvot is one obligated to give up his life and not violate, and which commandments of the Torah, the 613, is a person not obligated to give up his life. And not only that, the Talmud says, the Gemara says, v'chai b'hem. There's a principle in the Torah that for the majority of commandments of the Torah, a person is obligated to live. Which means that if a person, whether it was out of necessity or out of duress, but if a person had to violate a certain commandment in order to live, you're obligated to violate that commandment. So based on that, so if somebody is sick and there's on Shabbat, and you don't know if they're going to be able to live or not if you don't take them to the hospital, there's a safek pikuach nefesh. So you're not only are you allowed to break Shabbat, you're obligated to break Shabbat. You have to drop everything and break Shabbat. And this is what Hatzalah does on Shabbat. You're obligated to break Shabbat to the point that in the laws of Shabbat it says that Hanishal Harizim Meguneh. If somebody comes to the rabbi on Shabbat and asks, should I drive to the hospital? Should we break Shabbat in order to go to the hospital to save somebody's life? That is a terrible rabbi. He's a bad rabbi. Because in the time that they came to ask him, they could have already went. They could have already went to, and done something to save the person's life in those moments. And the rabbi should have taught the community and should have taught everybody, don't ask me on Shabbat. First drop everything and do what you need to do in order to save a person's life. But as a general rule, any commandment in the Torah, you're obligated to transgress in order to save a person's life. Except for three. There are three exceptions to the rule that the Gemara learns out from the Torah. The first one is idolatry, Avodah Zarah. If a person has to give up his life and not bow down to an idol or not worship an idol in Avodah Zarah, a person is obligated to give up his life and not participate in idolatry or worship an idol. The second one is Gilui Arayot, sexual promiscuity. That if a person, again, by at the cost of his life, he's told, you have to go sleep with a married woman, or you have to go sleep with a woman who's prohibited by the Torah, At the cost of your life, a person is not allowed to do it. Gilui Arayot is the second one. And the third one is Shefichut Damim. The third one is murder. A person is not allowed to commit murder and take another person's life, even at the cost of his own life. So Shefichut Damim, murder, is one of the big three. The three capital crimes that a person cannot do even at the cost of his own life. The Gemara says, how come? The Gemara says, we have no right to decide whose blood is redder. You don't know if your blood, how do you know whose blood is redder? Is your blood redder? You know?
The war is the same. Kill the soldier to save your own life. Doesn't apply to the laws of war. There's different laws.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well,
the act of war does not apply.
Right. So so we're talking about a personal case. Yeah. In the laws of war, something in terms of saving a country or saving people, it could be the different laws apply. But we're talking about a person. Himself. A person is not allowed to commit the act of murder, even to save his own life. This wasn't self-defense over here. This wasn't self-defense. Yes, excellent question. So yes, that's called a rodef. If there's somebody who is putting a gun to your head and they're trying to kill you, you're allowed to kill them first. Yes. But if the person put the gun to your head and said, kill somebody else, or murder somebody else, where you're not allowed to kill that other innocent person. That is the rodef. Meaning, a person who is going to kill somebody, he's already obligated in the death penalty for wanting to kill somebody. Right, so that person, yes, you're allowed to kill him. But if they tell you to kill an innocent person, a third person, you have no right to decide. Right? I mean, if you were American and the other guy was British, maybe we can decide. Right? Who's blood is
redder? You can rise up. Sorry, I forget the Hebrew. You can rise up and kill them before they kill you.
Right. So there's a distinction. Yes.
Before your life is threatened, if you know for sure.
Right, so you can kill the rodef, meaning the person who's trying to kill you, you're allowed to kill that person, because that person is a wicked person, they're already liable for the death penalty for wanting to murder. But if that person wanted you to kill another innocent person, you cannot decide that my blood is redder than the innocent person. In the Holocaust, the Jews had to deal with many, many of these types of situations where they were asked by authorities to choose between one or the other, or give us this or give us that. Very, very difficult and unfortunate circumstances that the Nazis, cruel, cruel circumstances that they put us through to have to try to make these kinds of choices, and we're not allowed to. So the Rambam codifies all of this in the laws of Yisurei Torah, and he also adds a very interesting type of case, that if there was, let's say, 10 of us, and the Nazis were to come, or the non-Jews were to come, and were say, give one of those 10, give one of the group, or we're going to kill all of you. So what's the law? Are we allowed to deliver, are we allowed to hand over a Jew? Are we allowed to hand over one of us? Or they say they're going to kill all of us. Are you allowed to? So the Rambam says, absolutely not. You're not allowed to. The only exception is if that person was actually liable to the death penalty. If the person actually committed an act where they were liable to the death penalty, where they should have been killed themselves, then maybe you're allowed to give that person over, and you know that that person was specified. They said, we want that guy. But otherwise, we have no right to decide.
I have a general problem with the ship example, because if you are truly God-fearing, you have a munah, your life is not in danger. In theory, that split second, some miracle could happen, rescue troops could come, you can... I have a very hard time saying that my life was in danger and use that as an excuse to kill somebody because I think I'm going to die.
You know, Rodney, that's exactly what the judges said. They said they weren't definitely going to die. They probably would have died. They could have been rescued at any moment. So, well done.
So, this is case number one. We had a case number two.
Right, so that deals with a criminal situation. What about compensation? Well, this was considered in the 1950s. It's another case also about a ship. Why is it about ships? problems happen a lot more with ships, where you're really stranded and have a necessity situation, argument, than they do day to day. So what happens is this. There's an oil tanker that is going, basically it's driving along. There's a problem with its steering gear. What happens is the oil tanker faces some really rough weather. Now, if you're in a ship and it's got really rough weather, you don't just feel seasick. The ship starts to sway and turn and do all kinds of other really horrible things. So the captain gets them into a river estuary to try and get out of that. And he ends up on something called a revetment wall, which is basically a very shallow area of water with lots of stones. And he thinks, oh my God, this is completely out of control. The ship's gonna crack, we're all gonna die. So he opens up the tanker and lets out 400 tons of oil, which damages the natural habitat of lots of fish and causes lots of damage to the neighboring people's land, who then sue and say, we need compensation for all this damage you've caused to our land. Question is, are they liable? Is the ship owner liable? Is the ship master liable? The ship ownership master said, we had no choice. People would have died, the ship would have gone. So in order to protect the ship, protect the life, we had no choice but to release these 400 tons. It was necessary. We've no liability. Question, are they liable to the landowners? Should we take another vote on this? Do they have to compensate the landowners? Who thinks yes? And who thinks no? Well, the yeses overwhelmingly have it. Let me tell you what the judge has said. So the judge has spent a while considering this, and frankly there were different answers at different levels. But the basic conclusions that they reached were, you can rely on the law of necessity if and only if it's not your fault. You can't say, well, you know, it's my fault that this has happened, but it was necessary for me to cause damage. But if it was necessary, you're not liable. And in this case, because of what happened, it was necessary to release all that oil. Otherwise, the people on the ship would all have died. Therefore, there was no liability. They said, we're not sure whether this would be right if it was just the ship we were talking about. Because why should he be able to choose that he can save his property by damaging someone else's? But for human life, by the time we get to 1950, that is okay. Now, this is very controversial. Because why should the landowners bear the cost rather than the ship? We're talking about financial liability. You're not talking about a crime. Someone has to bear this loss. The landowner didn't ask to have 400 tons of oil released onto their land. Well, what the court said was this. In authorities going back to the early 1600s, courts have said, this is a public policy question. There's no liability for saving people's lives because we want to incentivize people to always make the right choice and save life. And therefore, there's no monetary compensation. Now, here's a little twist, though. If you look in some of the books, if you look in some of the commentaries, as you get closer and closer to the modern day, people aren't sure that this is right. And if you look in different common law jurisdictions, the rule might be different. Say, for example, in America, the American restatements, they suggest that they would have to compensate. Maybe they would, maybe they wouldn't. The early cases are certainly very clear that they don't need to. by the early cases, I mean the ones obviously from 15 and 1600s. But law changes, law diverges over time, things develop. So what's the answer to this? Maybe you're all right. Just depends where you are and which corner you're in.
What about the halakhic point of view?
Wasn't there a local point in the Gulf of Mexico where people's lives were at stake, and some of it is also negligence, but lack of responsibility in keeping it up?
Yeah, there have been lots of leaks from Mexico in the Gulf. They haven't been able to successfully persuade a court that necessity was a defense to those ones.
They have to pay.
Okay. No. Oh, in the Gulf of Mexico, yeah, people paid a lot of money. A lot of money.
Do you agree that even the common law is not so much a pure common sense law? Like Hammurabi was totally from their own logical derivation. And also in the Torah refers to Sedom. Amorah, you know, they had a very, very, very strict law system, court system. It was enforced. Everything that they were doing was based on their logic. And that really doesn't exist anymore. I mean, even the common law is influenced by Christianity, which is a derivative of Torah that happened. But even that's not so much and you know, what we're trying to do here is to compare what the logic would as opposed to the Torah. But then even the logic is not so very logical. The logic is somewhat based on the Torah.
So it's an interesting point. I don't know about Sodom and Gomorrah, but if you go back to the Hammurabi code, that's one of the, for those who are interested, the Hammurabi was a king in ancient Mesopotamia, which is modern day Iraq, and one of the he was a very significant king then, and one of the many things he did was issue a law code known as the Hammurabi code. It's one of many old law codes where they cover certain laws. The Hammurabi code is very famous because it talks about lex talionis, eye for an eye. It covers some aspects of what today you would consider law. It doesn't cover everything. It's not the first one. There are earlier ones, but it's one of the famous early ones. But there are the way that those laws work, the legal codes, is different to the way that the common law works. In some ways, it's closer to the way that halakha works, but it's actually conceptually very different as well. The way that it works is you have a legal code, and the most famous of the legal codes nowadays are the Roman law code, Justinian's code, put together by the great Roman emperor Justinian, and that was essentially forms the basis for most continental European law systems, most Middle Eastern legal systems, not Israel, not Saudi Arabia, not Iran's, but most of them. And there are separate civil codes that form the basis of, for example, China and various other countries. The way in which the other famous one is the Napoleonic Code, which is the code that Napoleon put in force in place of Justinian's code, the Roman law code, across essentially the French Empire. The way that you do things under the code-based systems, what are known as the civil systems or the civilian systems, is you start off by looking at the code. And then, rather than focusing on cases, practical cases, you focus on the logic of the law, use the code as a starting point. You put a lot more weight on legal scholarship and the views that have been expressed, and you draw inspiration from those things. If you're interested particularly in the Hammurabi code, there's a lot of research that's been, and in ancient Mesopotamian legal systems, there's actually a lot of research that's currently being done, and some of the archaeology newsletters, particularly for that area, are publishing some cases that have been decided under those ancient law codes. But you know, for today's purposes, that doesn't matter. Common law affected by Christianity, I'm just trying to quickly unpack these things. Yes, Christianity does form part of the common law, or did form part of the common law. It's a little bit more complex than that, because within some countries, the way in which church and state is dealt with is different. And yes, Christianity has formed part of the common law. And for example, if you look at modern torts like negligence, do I owe a duty to my neighbour to do that, you know, to look after his property or not to harm him? One of the major reasons why there is such a duty is because of Christianity, because the judge has said, you know, as a Christian, obviously we owe duties to our neighbours. Look at what it says in, you know, whichever part of the New Testament. So, yes, Christianity forms part of it, but the way in which the common law actually goes about deciding cases, the way in which you argue cases in a common law court, the way in which you advise people on cases under the common law, actual concrete cases, isn't to go away and say, well, you know, the logic of this code is as follows, the coherency of the law leads to the following results. It's to look at previous cases, see the way in which they decided previous actual practical cases, look at the argument, the reasoning of the judgments in those cases, and to extrapolate those onto the principles of those into these cases. So,
okay, sure. Overall, fascinating. Yeah, we're gonna proceed on this, and then we'll do more questions at the end. It's okay. So it's the halakha. Does the oil company have to pay? Does the oil company not have to pay? So there's a passage in the Talmud, which is one of the bases for this general area with regards to necessity. It tells a story of David HaMelech, that David HaMelech wanted to go on a military campaign. He wanted to attack the Philistines in order to protect the Jewish people. And he had a question for the Sanhedrin. He had a question for the Supreme Court. Am I allowed to go attack the Philistines? Why is he asking this question? Because they were hiding amongst heaps of barley that belonged to other Jews. They belonged to other people. And as a method of killing them, eradicating, getting rid of the enemy, he wanted to set these heaps of barley on fire. He set them, and then you eradicate the Philistines. So he asked the Supreme Court, am I allowed to do this? Is this permitted? So the Gemara and Bava Kama, and the Gemara says that the court responded, you should know that the law is Asur la'adam lehatzil atzmo b'mamot chaviro. It's prohibited for a person to save himself with his friend's money. But they said, but you, since you're the king, this is, you're getting into the military, you're getting into saving the country, the king has rights that your average person doesn't have, and since you're the king, a king is allowed to break through other people's property, because the military needs it and because the country needs it, you're allowed to break through people's property without paying, and therefore for you it's permitted. But in the course of this discussion, the Gemara said that it's prohibited. It's prohibited for a person to save himself at the expense of somebody else, at the expense of damaging somebody else's property. Now, what does this mean? And there's a machloket Rashi and Tosfot, the two famous commentaries on the Gemara. Rashi says, and makes a comment that seems really wild, and thankfully it's not accepted as a normative halakha. Rashi says that when the court told David HaMelech that it's prohibited to save yourself by damaging somebody else's property at the expense of someone else's property, it means that it's prohibited as a criminal offense. Meaning that in this case of the oil tanker, the captain of the ship had to decide, I am not releasing the oil. If we die, we die. But we're not allowed to damage anybody else's property, and we're not allowed to do this, period. That appears to be, or seems to be, the opinion of Rashi. He says, because you're not allowed to, even at the expense of your, potential expense of your life, you're not allowed to damage this. It's a wild opinion. It's a wild out there opinion. But the Tosfot on the spot says, no, that's not what the question was, and that's not what the court was saying. The court was just responding to, not the criminal question, but the civil question of, are they obligated to pay? If you choose, yes, you have to save your life is more important, but are you obligated to pay somebody if you happen to damage their property when you're trying to save your own life? And about that, the court was saying that you're obligated to pay, and you're chayav to pay. And that is the halakha. According to Shulchan Aruch, codifies the Tosfot rights as that's Jewish law, that's a normative law, in Choshen Mishpat Siman Shin Nun Tet. Now, a related case which comes up in the Gemara, very interesting, and is discussed in Shin Pei in Shulchan Aruch over there, is let's say that a person is being chased by another person who wants to kill them. So A is chasing B with a knife. Now, B wants to save himself. Are you allowed to save yourself? Yes, you're allowed to save yourself. Now, how does he choose to save himself? He sees a vase, and he takes the vase, and he throws it at A, his attacker, breaks the vase, and in the process, the attacker is neutralized, A is neutralized, but he broke the vase. Is he obligated to pay for the vase, or is he not obligated to pay for the vase? Right? So, Shulchan Aruch draws a distinction. Important distinction to keep in mind. It says, who does the vase belong to? Right? If the vase belongs to A, belongs to the chaser, the guy who's chasing after you, no, you don't have to pay. You don't have to pay for it. The guy who's chasing after you, but his property is free game. Right? You can break the guy's vase. But if it belongs to a third person, if it belongs to a third guy, you're obligated to pay. You're obligated to pay that person because a person who saves himself using somebody else's property is obligated to pay for it and has to come with the understanding that I am liable to pay for it. Now, there's a third layer to this which is added, very interesting, and then we're going to get to the third case. And that is, there's also an exception created for a good Samaritan, if we're allowed to use that word, good Samaritan. Let's say that C, a third person, is watching all of this happen. You're watching A trying to attack B, and he's chasing after him with a knife. And now C, a third person, wants to save B, wants to save his friend B, and the way he saves him is, but he finds a vase and he throws it at A, and he injures A, neutralizes A, but the vase is broken. Does C have to pay for the vase or not? And there's a special exception made in the halakha that he does not have to pay. C does not have to pay. Why? In order to incentivize people to save Jews, in order to incentivize to save other people. So there's a special exception made that, unfortunately, right, the owner of the vase has to bear the damage. But C, the good Samaritan, so to speak, the third guy who's coming to save his friend, because in order to incentivize people to not be afraid to save people and not have any fear of liability, when you're going to save somebody else, you can break the vase and you're not liable to pay for it as the third time. B would pay. If you're saving yourself, I'm saving myself, I have to pay for it. I have to pay for the vase. I have to pay. But,
yeah. What is the actual good Samaritan law today? See somebody get beat up
Is there such a law in Manhattan?
So it varies depending on where you are, is the answer. But the general position across the common law world, and by that I say in most places, is there's no absolute immunity if you are a good Samaritan, if you're a rescuer. But the law looks upon you much more favorably. So you wouldn't be able to sue someone, you could sue anyone for anything ever, but you would be unlikely to succeed in a suit for negligently rescuing you, for failing to rescue you, etc., etc. That being said, if as a rescuer you go and damage things negligently, then you might be liable.
Yeah. You can't just use it as a carte blanche to go break things. Okay, should we get to the third case? Okay, third case, very interesting case, and it's going to involve a pharmacist. I hope you, I hope Melody allows us. So, similar case, but a little bit different. So this is a very, very, very famous thought experiment, actually, that was drawn up by or thought of, and there's different versions of it, but it was thought up by a Jewish psychologist, very famous, one of the most famous psychologists, and his name was Lawrence Kohlberg. And he came up with this thought, and he was very interested in morality and ethics. This was his area, was morality and ethics, and he came up with this dilemma that he called the Heinz Dilemma. I don't know if anybody has ever heard of it. The Heinz Dilemma. So there's a guy whose name is Heinz. His name is Heinz. And Heinz's wife is very sick. She is deathly ill, and she could potentially die. And he finds out that there is a drug that is able to cure her. So he goes to the pharmacist in order to get this drug. It has radium, I think, in the exam, whatever, but he goes to the pharmacist in order to get the drug. Now this drug costs $200. But the pharmacist says to Heinz, this is my drug, and if you want it, my price is $2,000. I charge $2,000. 10 times the price.
Inflation.
I charge $2,000 for that. Now, Heinz is unfortunately, and this is $2,000, I guess in the 1960s or 1970s, whenever he came up with this, probably was a lot more in nowadays terms, but Heinz is not able to afford the $2,000. He goes to everybody he knows and tries to collect money and tries to borrow money in order to pay for this drug and save his wife. He's only able to collect $1,000. So he goes to the pharmacist and he says, I collected $1,000. Can I buy this drug for $1,000? And the pharmacist says, sorry, my price is $2,000. Take it or leave it. You have $2,000? If not, not. And he said, he begs the pharmacist, and Heinz, this is before, I guess, the Heinz company. I don't know if it was anything related to ketchup, but the guy's name is Heinz. And he says, please, my wife is going to die. I'm giving you $1,000. It only costs $200. I'm giving you $1,000. I'm paying five times. And Heinz says, sorry. And the pharmacist says, sorry. This is a really terrible pharmacist. Heinz decides that he has no other choice. And in the middle of the night, he breaks into the pharmacy and he steals the drug in order to give to his wife and save his wife. And now is the question. And this is the question that Lawrence Kohlberg has. And that is, number one, did Heinz do the right thing? Is Heinz right to steal the drug? Number two, does Heinz have to pay for it? Is Heinz required to pay for the drug or not? Right? Is he obligated to pay the pharmacist for the $2,000, or is he not?
For
stealing the drug. She was cured. She was cured, yeah, but right now, but he stole. He stole. He committed larceny, right? He stole the drug, and now is he out? Now the pharmacist brings him to court. Does he have to pay, or does he not have to pay? Is this something that you're allowed to do, or something that you're not allowed to do? Okay. You want to start with the legal perspective, and then
I obviously have to be very careful about what I say here. Let me start by saying what you certainly must not do is steal from your pharmacist. And I say that as someone who has a lot of experience of suing people. I think the real question here is, can the pharmacist kill the wife? in all seriousness, in some ways this is, from a common law perspective, very straightforward, because we've already discussed the cases that deal with this. If the doctrine of necessity applies, then that would be a defense to theft, or larceny, or burglary, or whatever the relevant offense is that this person is charged with. So from a criminal perspective, they won't have committed a crime. From a civil law perspective, from an inter partes perspective, can the pharmacist sue for the money? As I've already said, anyone can sue for any reason, but will they succeed? Question mark. The answer is, it depends on which jurisdiction you're in. The American restatement of torts actually gives this as a specific example, someone who steals from a pharmacist. Both the patient and the doctor, and the patient's husband, because they can't afford it, or because they won't pay for it, and they say that there is a liberty to do so, but you have to pay for it. So that's the answer. Don't steal from my wife.
You're obligated to pay. So you have to pay for it?
Hang on. Yep.
Does common law have any laws in it for committing crimes against God?
So, interesting question. The answer is, it depends which jurisdiction you're in. They did used to have blasphemy laws.
Blasphemy laws in America?
According to common law, can you commit a crime against God?
In America, yeah. Until the 60s, they would enforce blasphemy laws in some states. It was only after the 60s.
Southern states.
In some of the southern states, yeah. It was only after the 60s where, in a case called Jamil and Wall, not Jamil and Wall Street, Sullivan and New York Times, where the Supreme Court said that the First Amendment interferes with various rights, that some of these laws were shut down. A lot of them came off the statute books earlier, but.
So what does Halakha have to say about this case? Can you steal from your pharmacist?
Yes.
In order to save a life?
Yes.
We're talking about in order to save a life.
In order to save a life.
We have to be very careful.
Be very careful.
So this in the Kol Shulchan Aruch in Yoredea Siman Shin Lamikvav, this actually pretty much exact case is discussed. And Shulchan Aruch says that a pharmacist only has the right to make a reasonable profit. It doesn't say the word, it doesn't define exactly what the word reasonable means, but a pharmacist only has the right to make a reasonable profit. They're not allowed to overcharge for the drugs that they are giving, and they can only make a reasonable. Therefore, if a person steals from the pharmacist, are they obligated to pay? Yes, they're obligated to pay. If you're saving a life, obviously, and life and death is a situation that's it trumps everything other than the big three that we discussed. So in that case, yeah, a person steals. They're not committing a criminal offense by stealing. But just as we said before in the second case, are they obligated to pay? You're causing damage to somebody. So yes, you are obligated to pay. How much are you obligated to pay? So, Shulchan Aruch says the following. The pharmacist, you have to pay her, or pay him, or I guess it could be male also, but you have to pay him an amount for them to make a reasonable profit. An unreasonable profit they are not allowed to make, but a reasonable profit for the cost of the drug, you're obligated to pay the pharmacist. However, there's also a distinction made. That's when it comes to a product, like a drug, which is being used in order to save somebody's life. But if a doctor wants to charge for an intervention that they want to do, which uses their chokhmah, which uses their wisdom. So, I want to do a surgery, right? And I spent however many years in medical school to learn how to do this surgery and this kind of surgery. A doctor has the right to say that this is my price, and I'm not doing this. Right. Yeah, we have a doctor.
This is why
So a doctor is allowed to say this is my chokhmah, this is my wisdom, this is my years of learning and my years of education. It's not a product which you can say there's a market price or a cost on this product. This is the price of my time and my wisdom and the chokhmah and that which I learned and my experience, and he can decide, and that's what his price is. And he can say, I don't do this surgery for less than that. I don't know if you're allowed to let somebody die. You have to actually. But you can say this is my price, and this is how much I charge for it. And there's no overcharge that can be considered for a person's wisdom, for the doctor's wisdom.
We have halacha against price gouging. Price gouging basically is against halacha.
Price gouging is against.
Which now only recently we have certain laws. If there's a natural disaster. During the pandemic, we saw it where they're arresting people.
Yeah, so it's an excellent question. In a general sense, correct. Price gouging is against halakha. But there are certain exceptions, without getting into details. There are exceptions and situations to it, but in a general sense, as a general rule, yeah, price gouging is correct.
Yeah.
Abraham paid the money for the cave.
Yes.
Kesef Malik.
Kesef Malik.
The highest price.
Did he break the halakha by paying more, by choosing to pay more? How come?
The guy was priced out.
It's an excellent question. If I'm not mistaken, and I haven't reviewed this recently, but I'm pretty sure my memory is serving me correct. Real estate is one of the exceptions.
You know what, this is why Judaism started with Yaakov. He understood this.
But I think property does not have a set value on it, because people have different preferences over what they value in a certain property, whether it's the location of it, whatever it might be. Everybody has a different preference of what they value. So there is no, in halakha, there is no overcharging when it comes to real estate, if my memory serves me correctly.
There's also a common law distinction between real estate and non-real estate things. That's why it's actually called real estate. It's because it comes from, the reason it's called real estate is because in the Middle Ages, you could get a real remedy or a non-real remedy. And a real remedy said, you've got to give them the property. And a non-real remedy or a personal remedy said, you've got to give them some money for compensation. And the only things they would order a real remedy for, an in-rem remedy, was for real estate, property. That's why it's called real estate, after the remedy that you would get in the medieval English courts. And even today, that there are different rules. So if you break a contract for the provision of land, that will the court will force you to hand over the land. If you break any other type of contract, most other contracts, you will be ordered to compensate rather than hand over the land, because land is each piece of land is unique.
You're describing that
it's a good question. It seems, if I'm not mistaken, it's even if it's that one pharmacist, based on their cost, to make a reasonable profit. A pharmacist is entitled to make a reasonable profit, but not to overcharge.
But you may be drawing a distinction between a situation where the pharmacist buys it and sells it on, and it's, for example, the exclusive distributor, and the pharmacist making it, applying their own knowledge. And maybe it's...
Yeah, maybe. Could be.
That's different than what happens in practice.
There are... You'll have to ask a pharmacist, but my understanding is that some things are bought in and sold. So.
Getting into trademarks and patents and things like that. I don't think it addresses such a thing.
So it's not my particular expertise, I should say, and a lot of it I've been reading up thanks to Gidon and thanks to this event. But I'm not a personally. Okay, there are rabbis. Most rabbis, I think, nowadays, majority usually are dealing with ritual law. We also learn these in theory. There are rabbis who sit on batedim. There are batedim who sit on courts and who are jurists, and there are jurists who deal with monetary law. And there are those who, over the centuries, they publish all of their decisions and everything that went into this decision. So trademarks and all, I'm sure it's dealt with. I'm sure it's been dealt with by courts and by those who have published their decisions. And really, ideally, in these kinds of cases, whenever there is a dispute between Jews, Jews are required to first go to a Beit Din. You're first required to go to a court. And even in New York, there are courts that will deal with and that will handle monetary cases. The law in America treats them as arbitrators. Just like in baseball and the MLB or in the diamonds, I think also in many industries, there are arbitrators. So the law does recognize a Jewish Beit Din as an arbitrator, and they have to sign an arbitration agreement usually before they go to the Beit Din. If the Beidin, for some reason, there's some aspect of the case that they're not able to handle, or they don't have the legal authority to handle it for you, they will send you to the secular courts to handle it. Like if they need to freeze a bank account, or they have things that they can't technically do themselves. But really, when two Jews have a dispute, by Jewish law, according to Halakha, your first stop, the first stop has to be to go to a Beidin. The first stop has to be to go to a Jewish court, before you go to a secular court. Yeah, that's a Jewish law. It's worthwhile to know.
We've been going for an hour. We've got two more examples that we can give you. Should we give you two, or should we just do one?
Start with one.
Yeah. All night. All right. Well, here's a quick one. Landlords. There's a property, this is a case from the 1970s. There's a property, and some squatters come in. The people who come in off the street and won't leave. And the landlord tries to evict them. They say, you're committing trespassing on our property. And they say, it's necessary for us to be here. It's a very rough area outside, and we'd be in danger if we slept on the streets. Is that a defence to trespass? Or can the landlord evict them? Or is that a defence?
Yes.
Okay. Should we do a show of hands? Can they stay?
Squatters' rights.
Must they leave? Great news. You're all correct. court basically said that there's no area where there's really that degree of necessity. Maybe in some obscure situation where they're being chased or there's the purge going on outside, you might be able to you might be able to go inside or break into someone's apartment and stay there for a little bit without being able to be evicted. But you can't go and squat in someone's property and stay there indefinitely and say, well, you know, it is somewhere to live. So that's normal.
And Halakha is pretty similar. A squatter has no necessity, is surely not a defense for squatting or living on anybody else's property. According to Judaism, according to the Talmud, a person has full right to evict a squatter for their property. Squatting, at no point can a person acquire property that way. Meaning, let's say these laws are discussed in the Talmud and Bava Batra, but let's say somebody sat on a land, and there's a general rule that if someone stays on a land for 3 years, it gives them a chazakah. I don't know if there's a word in English for chazakah, but it demonstrates that it belongs to them. If they've lived somewhere for 3 years and nobody has said anything to them, and no one has said anything. However, if someone stayed somewhere, he found an open apartment, piece of land, and he went and he stayed there for 3 years, stayed in the house for 3 years, and the landowner had no idea, and then the landowner comes back and sues him and says, this is my property. And the squatter, if he were to respond in court and say, it was just here, so I was here for 3 years and nobody said anything to me, that has zero legal standing. For if he makes that argument, then he can evict him right away. The squatter or the person sitting there has to say, this belongs to me. I bought it from you. He has to have some claim to the property. You cannot just say, it was here, and since it was here, it belongs to me, or I have some right to the property. There is a fascinating discussion, which I don't know if it exists in common law also. Can, after the fact, whenever the landlord finds him there, can you charge him rent for the time that he stayed there? The landlord is allowed to evict him 100%. Can the landlord come and say, you stayed on my property for 12 months and you have to pay me a full year of rent? You owe me a full year of rent for the amount of time that you stayed on my property. If you continue to stay on my property, you also owe me rent for continuing to stay on my property. So the halakha says the following. The halakha says that there is a law called Kofin al Midat Sedom, which means that we... if the type of property is not one that one would normally rent, if it's not one that's normally rented, so it's a house or it's a type of place that people would not assume that it's something that somebody normally rents, it's just a place that somebody lives in. So by the squatter living there, the average landlord, this is called by normal people, is not really losing anything, right? Which means he's benefiting, the squatter is benefiting, the landlord's not really losing anything because this is not a type of place which would normally be rented. So in that type of a situation, the landlord cannot charge him rent. Why? Because kofina midat sedom. Because that's Sodom and Gomorrah. Sodom and Gomorrah, even though I'm not losing anything, I'm going to charge you for it anyways. Don't be like Sodom and Gomorrah. You're not losing anything. Don't charge him. But if he comes to him and says, leave, you need to get out of here, he gives him an eviction notice, he can say, from this moment on, if you stay here, I'm charging you rent. He's allowed to charge him rent. But he cannot go back after the fact and charge him rent. However, if it was a type of property, which is a rental property, it's an apartment building, everybody here is renting, and there's an open apartment, and he found the apartment, and he sat there, and he squatted there, and he stayed there for 6 months, the landlord, according to Jewish law, according to halakha, can come to him, not just evict him, he's allowed to evict him, and on top of that, he's allowed to say, you owe me 6 months of rent. And he can make a squatter pay for the 6 months of rent that he sat there in his apartment.
So the position of the common law is very clear on this, on both these points. Firstly, under common law, you can get possession, you can get ownership just by staying somewhere for an extended period of time. The principle is called adverse possession, and basically the way that it works is if you stay in a particular area for sufficiently long, then the plot, and you satisfy.
New York is 30.
There we go. I think it may be less than that actually in New York.
We had a case 13.
Right. Fine.
It certainly does not exist in Halakha. It does not.
Then they can own it. There are three requirements that you have to satisfy, which for those Latin speakers out there is nec vi, nec clam, nec precaria. For those of you that don't speak Latin,
the accent was not Latin.
You're correct. For those of you, it's actually what's known as English law Latin, which is Latin words pronounced in the way in which you would pronounce them as if they were English. That's the way in which people use these things in court. I'm completely serious. There's a specific correct pronunciation. Basically, what it means is you can't use force, you can't hide what you're doing, and you can't have permission of the landlord to be there. And those are the three requirements. And this often comes up with neighbourhood disputes, where you have two adjoining properties and someone builds a fence on someone else's land, for example, or you know, puts their sheep on it, or whatever scenario you happen to be dealing with. Can they get rent? Good luck collecting rent from squatters. But at least as a matter of legal theory, yes, you can. Does it matter whether it's a rental property or a non-rental property? If it's a rental property, it's much easier to say how much is it that they have to pay you, but they have to give you compensation in both situations. Right. I think we do have time for one last case, because this one's really fun.
Excellent. I don't really have halakha on this one. Yeah. This is the finale from... don't really want to talk about
this. This is a real 21st century case.
Sure.
If you're starving, you have a non-kosher animal to survive.
Yes.
How do you pack a shed?
It's an excellent question. So this is more of a type of what a rabbi might deal with as an actual question is, if a person is in a life and death situation, are they allowed to eat non-kosher?
And they eat non-kosher.
That itself is also a question. Do you say a bracha? So there's a question of, can I eat non-kosher if my life is at risk? Can I eat non-kosher if my life is not at risk, but I'm just very sick? Somebody's just very sick, and am I allowed to eat non-kosher just in order to feel better? am I allowed to eat non-kosher? That's one question. Then there is a second question. Do I have to make a bracha on it or not? It's actually a question. It's a very, very famous dispute between the Rambam and the Ra'avad. And the Rambam says, absolutely not, you never make a bracha on anything that's non-kosher. And the Ra'avad says, no, you get pleasure or benefit from the world, you make a bracha on Hashem for it. It doesn't matter if it's not allowed, you make a bracha. Even if a person eats pork, you eat ham, yeah, you should make a bracha, according to the Ra'avad. But the halacha is like the Rambam. The halacha is no. The person, you never make a bracha on non-kosher. If somebody had the idea of making a bracha on non-kosher, I'm sorry.
There we go. So we don't need to.
So
there
are
wash before
non-kosher animal, and let's say vegetation that is grass.
Yes, absolutely. So all of this, it depends on the illness, depends on the situation. Obviously, because nefesh, someone is going to die, you're allowed to give it to them. But every question is asked and discussed. Number one, are you ingesting it orally, or is it something that's being administered or given to you in a different way? Is it a food that actually has a good taste and is sweet, or is it a food that is like a swallowable and doesn't have any taste to it at all? What type of non-kosher is it? Is it non-kosher that comes from animals, or is it a different type of non-kosher? So all of those are factors that play out in these kinds of questions. But it's an excellent question, and rabbis, we get it all the time. I got a question a couple of times, very interesting, of sometimes if they want to do a valve replacement for a heart, and they want to use a pig valve. Yeah, so they want to use a pig valve. So is that allowed or is it not? So specifically when it comes to pig, the only prohibition of the Torah is to ingest it. So you're actually absolutely allowed to use a pig valve in order to...
It goes to the saving of the life over the...
Yes. Yes, that as well. So
that's a pig leather shoes.
So these are the laws that ritual laws that we deal with on a regular basis. Pesach all the time. If there's a vitamin or if there's a medication that may have chametz in it, am I allowed to eat it on Pesach? Very, very similar type of question, same type of question. So these we regularly address all the time. But I don't want to take away from Gideon's finale.
All right, one last scenario. Now, to understand this, you need to understand the way that current international relations work. There is a thing called an investment treaty. An investment treaty is an agreement where countries say, investors from this foreign country, if you invest in me, I will be nice to you. It's specific. So, Argentina, and they say, if I'm not nice to you in the ways in which I promise, you can sue me and I will give you compensation. Right. So Argentina enters into various bilateral investment treaties with various other countries. They promise that they will not expropriate the assets. They won't unlawfully take away without compensation the assets, any kind of assets that people invest in Argentina from these countries. And they'll treat those investments, they'll give those investments fair and equitable treatment. In the early 2000s, Argentina has a serious economic crisis. Really, a lot of you will remember, very serious economic crisis. And they introduced various policies, including one called asymmetric pesoization. Now, asymmetric pesoization, the way that works is they say every contract that exists with various Argentinian entities, we're now changing it so that the price is payable in pesos, not in whichever currency it currently is in. And the way in which we're going to do this is we're just going to strike out whatever currency is in the contract and replace it with pesos. At the time, there were 10 pesos to the dollar. And so various telecoms and energy companies said, all these contracts we have with these Argentinian entities have now had 90% of their value knocked off them. That's not fair or equitable treatment, and you've taken away all of our assets, and you've unlawfully expropriated our assets. And they sued Argentina. And Argentina said, among other things, well, it was necessary for us to introduce this. We as a nation, we have to do this, because we were in such dire economic position that we had to do this. We had to save our economy. This was all, these were the steps that we took. So, was that a defense to taking away 90% of the value of these contracts? Let's take a vote on this. Who thinks that Argentina successfully defended those claims on the basis that it was necessary for pesoization? Hands up for almost nobody. Getting a few more? Not sure. And who thinks that that was not successful? Well, some people voted twice. And you're right to do so, because the way that this worked out is there were several different claims, and they all reached different conclusions. And so some tribunals decided that it was, some tribunals decided that it wasn't. In one case, the same investor sued to two different treaties, and won one and lost the other, using the same evidence. So the people were suing. People were suing. No. For various complex reasons, someone was able to sue under two treaties for exactly the same amount, on exactly the same thing, using exactly the same evidence. Both Argentina and the investor put in exactly the same evidence. And in one case, they were awarded a few hundred million dollars. And in the other case, they were awarded nothing, and Argentina won them. On necessity for the same job.
Would that be on, let's say, profit versus cost issue?
There are various different ways of assessing the value of investments, but yes.
But what you're going to recoup is the diluted currency.
No, you recoup your loss.
You're winning pesos.
No, you get your investment loss.
From who?
From Argentina. From the Argentinian state. They have to pay compensation.
But they have the money.
Argentina, this does. You can enforce against any assets Argentina has anywhere in the world.
They saved their nation.
That's not
according to Halakha, you keep bankruptcy on yourself.
Right.
It's a similar idea if you're paying less than you actually
owe. So this is an area I don't have the answer to. I don't know, maybe a Dayan, if there's a rabbi who has an expertise on a Jewish court and serves on a Bedin and has more expertise than it, maybe they'll have the answer to it. I don't know. But I don't have the answer on this.
I know what the answer is. Argentina based on fiat and a horizontal
basis.
It cannot change
value. It could be. I don't know. I don't know.
If it was Israel in a similar situation, how would you?
I would refer it to higher rabbis than me. I'm not qualified at least for this question. At least at this moment, I don't have the answer. Maybe one day, Bezrat Hashem, I don't know. But there are definitely much greater rabbis who have expertise and who might be able to answer this question. I don't know. I personally don't know.
Do you have a question or a question? Not a question, but a question.
Yes. It's a very excellent question. Very, very, very good question. So I'll tell you where we commonly get this question is there's a woman who's pregnant and she's in her ninth month, and when she goes into labor, she wants to go to the hospital, and they will always ask us, I want another woman to go with me, other than my husband. As awesome and as amazing as a husband he is, but it's nice to have my mother with me. It's nice to have a woman who has some experience in the delivery room to be able to come with me. And Rabbi Ben Chaim's answer is as follows in that situation. And he says that it's okay to have a second person come with you in the hospital and to be an advocate for you can also be life and death. Because sometimes if a person is alone in the hospital by themselves and they have nobody with them to advocate for them, That can also be a cause for either the doctors don't take them seriously enough, or the doctors don't realize they have a problem. Sometimes when their family member is with them, they realize something is happening, they call a nurse, they call a doctor right away. So it's very important to have a second person there, and a second person with the knowledge and the experience. But beyond that, beyond having more people, no, you shouldn't. Having more people, they shouldn't go to the hospital, but to have at least one person, to have a person, in the case of a pregnant woman, a mother or a woman who can go with her, is very important, and therefore she is allowed to go with them to the hospital. But to have a whole pakeshki and have a whole after Shabbat, to finish during COVID. For sickness also, to have an advocate at the hospital is very important. There's a very fascinating question that comes up for Hatzalah, that Hatzalah deals with, and this question was brought to Moshe Feinstein. And that is, Hatzalah is obviously allowed to take a patient to the hospital. The question is, are they allowed to come back from the hospital? Once you get to the hospital, so now you're not in a life and death situation anymore. Are you allowed to come back and go home from the hospital at that point? So Rav Moshe Feinstein, who was probably the top rabbi in America in the 20th century, so he gave an answer to Hatzalah, which Hatzalah follows until today, where he says yes. And what's his reasoning? His reasoning is as follows. He says that it is a life and death situation. Why? Because for somebody who's working in Hatzalah, if he hesitates for a second to take the next person to the hospital, it could cause a life and death situation. So if he thinks to himself, I might not be able to get back. If I go to the hospital tonight, on Friday night, I go to the hospital tomorrow morning, I'm going to get stuck there. So should I go on this call or should I not go on this call? Or every single time I go, my wife is complaining. Right? Stephanie's never complaining. But every single time I go to the hospital, my wife is going to go, so maybe I should go, maybe I shouldn't go. If he hesitates for a second, then it can cause somebody to die, and therefore, Rav Moshe Feinstein said that Hatzalah members in particular are allowed to go and are allowed to come back, and are allowed to come back from the hospital on Shabbat, but that's not for the average person. Average person, if you go to the hospital, you have to stay there, and you have to be there for after Shabbat. There are some nowadays, and actually Rabbi Ben Chaim's personal opinion is, Hatzalah doesn't follow it, Rabbi Ben Chaim's personal opinion is, and there are places in Brooklyn that follow this, that the Hatzalah in Brooklyn, in Flatbush and in some places in Brooklyn, they have non-Jews on call at the hospital for all of Shabbat. And they say that, okay, we need to take back the Hatzalah member who comes to the hospital on Shabbat, but better for him not to drive himself. Let's have a non-Jew on call that they hire from before. They have a non-Jew who is on call and have a goy who's going to drive them back. The Hatzalah member takes whoever it is to the hospital, but they have a non-Jew who drives them back from the hospital on Shabbat. And if a Hatzalah can arrange for that, Rabbi Ben Chaim thinks that that's better. I think they're working on it for Great Neck, but they're not there yet. Great Neck does not have it yet. But most of the Hatzalahs, they follow Rav Moshe Feinstein's ruling, who said that Hatzalah members in particular are allowed to drive back for this reason.
Did you have a question?
All they are going to say is, for example, stealing from a pharmacy, what if you're like a drug addict? What if it's self-inflicted?
That's a tough question. Is it life and death? Opioids?
Yeah.
That's a good question. I don't know if that's considered life and death, though. I don't know if it's considered life and death. I don't know if you can argue necessity. I don't think you can argue necessity.
Depends on the drug you're addicted to. If it's insulin, for example, that might be different to heroin.
And it's a good place to pause. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
our speakers for tonight. Thank you to our speakers. Thank you to everyone who came out tonight. If you would like to be informed about future events like this or any of the other amazing events we have, we quite literally have events daily and weekly, every day. They're also streamed by Moshe, as well as the other teachers and speakers in the community. There are weekly bigger events like this. So if you'd like to be informed of future events like this, you can find me right after. There are both a men's chat for the learning events as well as a women's chat. There's going to be a women's event coming up starting in February. There's a big kickoff event and a semester of classes. There's going to be, again, men's classes literally every day in this building and the buildings in the community. So if you'd like to be informed about it, please find me right after to be added to the chats.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good job.
Thank you very much.
Expecting part two of the topic. Good turnout. You expect a part two?